Finally today, in the wake of the US election, let's return to the acclaimed American commentator and author E.J. Dionne. 2 weeks ago, on the eve of the election, E.J., who's well known to RN Breakfast listeners for his analysis, explained the 200-year-old division in America between communitarians and individualists. It's the subject of his latest book, Our Divided Political Heart, The Battle for the American Idea in an Age of Discontent. Well, Barack Obama, who made something of an unexpected guest appearance on last week's show, won the election on a clearly communitarian platform. One of the striking things to come out of E.J. Dionne's book is the parallel between the debates today about elitist liberals versus conservative populists and the debates in the early 1800s. It seems the same split existed between the founding fathers, with Thomas Jefferson on one side and Alexander Hamilton and Henry Clay on the other.
What you had, I think, was Jeffersonian democracy involved the equality of all white men. And precisely because the Hamiltonians and the Whigs, the Clay's party, sort of believed in essentially class inequality, they could, in some sense, be far more liberal on both race and gender. And it is true that the Federalists and the Whigs were more anti-slavery, include a larger anti-slavery wing, even though there were Southern Whigs who were pro-slavery, and were also somewhat more advanced on the issue of women. Evangelicals, actually, in this early period, were more advanced on women and their rights than others. So there is that element. But I think it's still important to recognize this inflection in our history in the populist and progressive era when the 19th became the 20th century, where these kind of traditions got mixed up a little bit and reinterpreted to some degree. But yes, elitism is something both sides in our politics have always used against each other, and you see it again today in this election. The Republicans like to argue that the Democrats and President Obama represent some sort of intellectual and cultural elite, and the Democrats, including President Obama, argue that the Republicans represent a financial elite. And there's something to each of their criticisms of the other.
Now, I'm very glad you mentioned populism because it is a very misunderstood political doctrine. Every time I hear an Australian politician or commentator denounce populism, I'm not sure they know exactly what they're talking about. As you point out, and as Michael Kazin, another distinguished historian, points out, populism embodied both a Protestant piety, but also a very Enlightenment view that the ordinary person, the working man, the working woman, knew as much about their world and their destiny as their ancestral overlords.
Right, exactly right. I have exactly the same reaction you do to the misuse of the word populism, but maybe that's why we've known each other and talked to each other for 20 years. Because when you look at our American populists and the actual movement that went under that name, yes, there were some nativist elements in it. Yes, there was some popular prejudice, but no more popular prejudice than existed in other parties. But in fact, they were a very forward-looking movement. And in many ways, and this is particularly the more scholars have gone back to look at them, the more they realize that there was a very progressive element. They were not trying, as some of their critics said, to roll back modernity. They simply wanted to share modernity's gifts more broadly. They were often known as a reading and writing party. They brought study groups into very rural areas of the United States. And so I have an instinctive desire when I hear populists run down an attack to want to defend the populist tradition, because if you are a small-D Democrat, if you do believe in self-rule, in one person, one vote, then you have to admire those aspects of the populist tradition which were deeply democratic, deeply egalitarian, and based not on prejudice, but on a desire for a mass education in the interests of an informed democracy.
And the standard bearer of populism, William Jennings Bryan, whose reputation I always feel obliged to redeem because he's known only as a religious fundamentalist, his objection to Darwinism was as much, if not more, an objection to social Darwinism rather than science, wasn't it?
Well, very much so. I mean, what you said about William Jennings Bryan is reflected in a wonderful recent book by the historian you mentioned, Michael Kazin, where Bryan was a religious fundamentalist. He was also very broadly progressive on a whole series of issues, including, by the way, women's suffrage and the support for trade unions and all sorts of other progressive measures. And you also write about social Darwinism, that when Darwin came along, advocates of the status quo said, right, survival of the fittest is the way of the world. The government should not intervene on behalf of those who are left out or impoverished, because if we just let the system work itself through, the strong will survive and we'll all become stronger. And Bryan and a lot of the progressives and the populists said, no, this is not sensible as social policy. It's not the way to build a stronger country. And so this is one of the many ways in which certain evangelical Christian strains, so often seen as supporting more conservative principles in politics, actually were allied to some of the most progressive tendencies in our politics and in politics of other nations as well.
Well, finally, EJ, this tension between communitarianism and individualism and the repeated distractions by the so-called culture wars, they've been a consistent theme of your work for 21 years, ever since your first book, Why Americans Hate Politics. And you said that was a book about the false moral choices that Americans were being forced to make. What did you mean by those false moral choices, and are Americans still being forced to make them?
We're still having a lot of that kind of politics, unfortunately. I mean, I don't like culture war politics because culture war politics exploits our discontents when the purpose of democratic politics, as I see it, is to heal them, is to heal and solve problems. So, for example, way back then, there were arguments about whether you could either be pro-family or pro-feminist, but you couldn't be both. And that was silly because many, many people, especially if they are the fathers of daughters, believe strongly in equal rights for women. They understand that women will join the workforce. That doesn't mean you're opposed in any way to the family. It means you want to adapt our structures to save the family and to have equal rights for women. Now, one could say the same about the movement for gay rights. To support the rights of gays is not to be anti-family. To support the environment is not to be against economic growth. It's to find forms of growth that are compatible with environmental protection. And we could go down a long list like this. And similarly, in our divided political heart, I do not want to chuck liberty in favor of community. I think this balance that we have sought is an intelligent balance. We're talking not about an all-enveloping communitarianism where the individual would be snuffed out. We're talking about the fact that individuals who want to live freely and live well also seek forms of community. I think this struggle between the two is eternal is an awfully big word, but I think it's a struggle that we will continue to have, and as long as we're having it, we're on the right track, because I don't think most free people in any given society want to snuff out liberty or community. And so I'm fighting for balance, not for any victory of either of these sides.
Well, EJ Dionne, it's been a pleasure to talk to you, as always. Your book is called Our Divided Political Heart, The Battle for the American Idea in an Age of Discontent. It kind of caps 20 years of thinking on this issue, and I'm very glad that you could share some time with us. EJ, thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and it's always fun to talk to you.
You can hear all of today's stories again at our homepage on the RN website, where there's also some extra audio of Professor Patrick Parkinson talking about research on the causes of clergy sex abuse. You can download or podcast our stories, leave a comment or follow us on Twitter. Thanks to producer Mark Franklin and technical producers Jennifer Parsonage, Marty Peralto and Paul Goff. That's the program for this week. I hope you'll come back next week.